Good morning, everybody. We are live. It is 6 o'clock on the dot, the Gareth Cliff Show, Friday morning, and it is the 24th of July. Let's get cracking. We have so much to do today, so many interesting guests, lots of things to talk about. I think you will find yourself by the end of this pretty well informed about what's going on in the world around you, or at least entertained. That's hopefully our purpose. We're going to be joined in a short while by one of my favorite guests, perennially one of my favorite guests on the show, someone who's always got inspiring and forward-looking and astronomical ideas of where we should be focusing our attention. I know you know. Professor David Block will be joining us shortly. We're going to talk about some amazing, enormous, universal, galactic events that are happening. And he always gives us perspective on things that I think we need to be reminded of in a world where there's so much chaos and like human stupidity around us on a daily basis. It's good to know that there are things, celestial objects, that still control much of what we do, how we behave, where we go, what the universe is all about. It's one of the reasons I like to look up with Professor David Block every now and then. We're also going to be joined a little later by somebody who has been an economist and an expert on the show a couple of times. There's a lot to talk about there. The Reserve Bank kept the interest rate the same yesterday, which everybody expected to go up. We'll find out what that means. That is Julieta Talevi, who's been a regular on the show too. So we're bringing back some of the favorites this week. Want to find out what you're up to, and we'll be checking in on the comments regularly through the course of the show as well. And then a little later on, we're going to speak to somebody called Lloyd Matthew, who has got an amazing new technology, which you might not even know, but is being used and being put into action everywhere already. And if you've ever used, you know, Siri or Alexa or any of those things, you will know that voice is becoming steadily the most popular way for people to communicate with technology, in particular AI. And how can you put your voice to better use? And how can you also figure out what's real, what's human, and what's machine? So we got all of that and more still to come. Janine is running the show. And James, is James even around this morning? I don't even know if he's even awake this morning, but I suppose we'll find out. Who knows? Let's get cracking. We've got many things to do. I'm going to start off by bringing on our favorite professor, Professor David Block. Let's get him in here and see what he's up to on this chilly July morning, because I think he's heading to Egypt soon, and we're going to find out what that's all about. So let's welcome Professor David Block. Hey, Prof.
Hi, Gareth. It's awesome to be with you again, to see your wonderful smiling face, and just to be looking up with Gareth this breezy winter morning.
Well, Prof, it's always nice to see you. I tried to frame your appearances on the show as being, you know, these monumental things, and in many ways they are. But you know, you're more than a scientist and astronomer. You're a very inspiring man. I always get messages from people after you've been on that you've made them feel better. You've either made them feel smaller, or you've made them feel much, much bigger. But I think what you do is you give us context and perspective, right? So, where are we in the universe at the moment? What important things are going to be happening soon up in the skies that we need to be paying attention to?
Yes. Well, you've already alluded to the fact, Gareth, that I'm heading off to Egypt in just around 2 weeks' time, by the end of July, and it's extremely exciting. This is an event which cannot be missed, but the actual eclipse is a year away. This is called the eclipse, the solar eclipse of the century. And it's going to be happening on August the 2nd next year. But so why am I heading off to Egypt now? Well, there's a tremendous amount of planning to be done. This is the sort of World Soccer Cup, but for astronomers. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the event, the solar eclipse, which I'll go into in a moment, the eclipse is happening over Luxor. Now, ancient Luxor was, in fact, Thebes, the home of the pharaohs, and the Nile is right there. But what's going to be happening, Gareth, is this, that in, on the 2nd of August next year, the face of the moon will obscure that of the sun, as you can see above me, a solar eclipse. And now listen to this. The totality, in other words, the period of darkness, which is normally a minute or two, is going to be about 6.5 minutes. So that is extraordinary. Now, because it's Luxor, because it's desert, you are going to be able to see the shadow of the moon sweep across the desert sands in Luxor at a speed, I estimate, of between 1,800 kilometers per hour to 2,000 kilometers per hour. I mean, that is staggering, much faster than a commercial jet, which cruises at about 900 kilometers per hour. This is nearly 2,600 kilometers per hour. I've seen this before, Gareth, but never like on this magnitude in a solar eclipse, is that you actually see the shadow of the moon sweeping across the Earth at speeds which exceed the Concorde speeds of around Mach 2. 2,180 kilometers. So it's really just exceptional. And also, what's so exceptional is that it's all in the desert, so that you'll get no.
But Prof, there's more. There's even more to this, and I don't want to get too philosophical or spiritual or quasi religious about this, but Egypt is also, in many ways, you know, Egypt and Sumeria are the ancient first astronomers. These are the places where the precession of the stars, the zodiac, as we call it in the sky, the constellations which are observed by our ancient ancestors, the places where the first observatories were set up. In some ways, thousands of years later, to be alive, for those of us who are alive at this time in the year 2026 and 27. To be able to see it in those places is, I think, quite an extraordinary thing. It's perhaps a coincidence, some people will say, but these places are imbued in the very most ancient knowledge about what is in the heavens, right?
Oh, I love the word imbued. I mean, there you are. It's infused with centuries of observing, Gareth. You are so right. I mean, isn't that the place of Alexandria? Isn't that the place of the ancient observatories, the ancient, stargazing, looking up, the ancient temples? I mean, this is the place where so much astronomy happened. You know, I had a StreamYard meeting with someone in Los Angeles, and we were just discussing that Eratosthenes, I mean, it is just unbelievable. He actually proved that the Earth is round and not flat. And he got it right to within a few percent. I mean, it's staggering, all done from Egypt. And in fact, you'll remember I was one of the team members to find out that the desert, that Tutankhamun, who wore this desert stone, actually was a result of a comet which exploded in the atmosphere. But I don't want to go into that right now. But it just goes to show that the ancient Egyptians were master observers of the night sky. And this is what I'll be doing in Egypt, Gareth, is I need to scout out the best observing sites. The ideal observing sites, of course, have to be relatively crowd-free, which is going to be very difficult, you know, because it's like, as I said, an astronomy World Cup. The hotels in Luxor, Gareth, have been booked out 3 years ago. To give you an idea. 3 years ago. I mean, this is, if you were to go onto any of the normal booking sites, you'll get bookings now at a hotel for one night for 300,000 rand. That's true. I've actually gone onto such sites. So what we are doing, Gareth, next year is the hope is I'll be a team leader and we're going to be chartering a boat to cruise down the Nile and then to see the eclipse, because you just can't get any accommodation anywhere. It's just at an all-time high.
This is obviously a daytime event because solar eclipses, you'll see the shadow, as you say, that the moon will pass between the sun and the earth. But normally, most of your observations happen at night, and you need places that aren't too populated. So the worst place to be if you were doing nighttime observation would be on the Nile, because it's the most populated part of the continent, let alone, you know, I mean, if you go nearer to Cairo, there's so much light pollution, it would be almost impossible for you to see at night. But during the day, this will be absolutely amazing on the Nile.
It is unbelievable because, of course, we are looking at our brightest star in the day skies. It's the sun. And it's actually the best place to be, Luxor, because not only because of all the temples and everything else, but it's also the best place to be because, and not many people are aware of this, Gareth, but the sun is almost going to be at the zenith at the time of totality. So, I mean, you can't have a better place, you know, no obscuration, Gareth, from buildings. You see the observatories behind me. No obscuration from, you know, any tall buildings or whatsoever near the horizon. Here is a remarkable event where you actually just will be looking straight up at the eclipsed sun. So everything is working correctly for the eclipse of the century. And just like the soccer World Cups are planned many years in advance, so astronomers have to plan these events very, very meticulously, because you've got this span of 6.5 minutes of totality. And so all my camera equipment, my zoom lenses, all my equipment has to be precisely aligned and ready, because 6.5 minutes goes along so quickly. But what will you see, Gareth? This is amazing. You know, as the face of the moon obscures that of the sun, you suddenly see a ring around the sun, the diamond ring effect. You can see it essentially behind me on the background. And you see the last rays of the sun impinging on the lunar hills. And those are called the Bailey beads. As you know, the sunlight just impregnates the remaining distant lunar domains. It is staggering to see. It's emotional to see. Gareth, you have to be with us. I mean, it's just like the Soccer World Cup, and that goal goes in, and the crowds rise in excitement. This is an event, Gareth, that even if you had to pay 300,000 rand for the night, you can't miss it. It's a once in a lifetime.
Prof, have you been to Egypt before?
No, Gareth, I've never been to Egypt before. Traveled rather extensively in my lifetime, but I've never been either.
No, I've never been to Egypt.
And as you've said before, I mean, Cairo, I have got no desire to see because it's just so overpopulated, I'm told. But I will be on the West Bank, near the Nile, the West Bank in Luxor, near the Valley of the Kings, where the pharaohs are buried. I will also be looking at sites near the, I sent you a photograph, in fact, of these gargantuan statues, the colossi of Menmon. I want to, Gareth, you know, before all the crowds come, I want to scout out just the very quietest, the very best sites to set up all our equipment, to look up. But you can't do this then. It's far too late. You've got to plan this meticulously. Gareth, this is not the only exciting event. There's also an eclipse of the moon this year on Friday, August 28, a partial lunar eclipse, which will be visible from South Africa, starting at 3:23 a.m. right through to the morning hours, 6:26 a.m. And there, of course, you'll see the reverse. You'll see the Earth's shadow falling on the moon. That's
Prof, I got a question here from Mo Rabbit, who's listening to us live this morning. And there are lots of people who are very pleased to see you again. But Mo Rabbit says, will you be able to see this eclipse, the solar one, which you're going to Egypt for. Will you be able to see it here in South Africa in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yes, now that's a very interesting question. And the answer is regrettably no, not at all. The reason is the path of totality is an exceedingly narrow path. So you actually have to be right, for example, in Luxor, and the path sweeps through Luxor, Northern Africa, just a tiny part of Gibraltar and so forth. But it's exceedingly narrow path. With solar eclipses, you really, it's not like lunar eclipses. It's such an interesting question. Lunar eclipses, you can see from vast areas of the Earth. Solar eclipses, for example, if there's a solar eclipse happening in the skies above Chile, as you see in my background, you have to be in Chile. You have to actually be over that specific city. It's very, very narrow and very delineated. So nothing whatsoever from South Africa. In fact, if you like 200 miles from Luxor, you also won't see the total solar eclipse. It's that narrow. It's a very, very narrow path indeed. And that's why you need to actually go to be within the domain of totality to be able to see it, Gareth.
So the lunar eclipse that's on the 28th of August, we will be able to see here in South Africa?
Yes, absolutely. So I've got the exact timings here. At the eclipse begins at 3:23 a.m. The partial eclipse of the moon enters the Earth's very dark shadow at 4:30, and the maximum eclipse is at 6:12 a.m. It's not a total eclipse. About 93% of the moon's diameter will be immersed in the Earth's shadow. But it's still a beautiful event to see.
Well, we'll be doing a show that morning, so we'll catch the tail end of it. But most of us will be up early anyway on that Friday, the 28th of August. So maybe we'll catch it in time.
Oh, I think I really encourage all your listeners to go outside in the early morning hours on the 28th. I always remember as a young schoolboy, you know, Gareth, my father built me my observatory, as you know, in Krugersdorp, and it was wonderful to look up. You know, people often ask me at these eclipses, people often ask me why I get so excited about them. And I think that with all the with all that's happening on terra firma, when the astronauts recently went up the Artemis mission, they looked at the pale blue dot. They looked at the Earth and they gleaned a new perspective. I love that comment, Gareth. You have to visit Egypt. One of the best holidays I've been in on my life. If you love history, it's a must. Well, I want to tell you, Elise Bester, if you love history and if you love looking up, you need to be on this chartered cruise of ours.
You're not just saying that because you're trying to be nice and sounding. You actually do take groups of people. So you went, famously, we spoke to you about a year and a half ago about your trip to the Northern Lights, which was hugely successful. And you took a group of people up there and got them to see what is probably one of the most spectacular things you will ever see when you look up. And is available there for people to see. But very few of us ever get to go into the Northern Hemisphere as far as that. You went into Norway, as I recall.
And see
the magnetosphere of the Earth and the way that it behaves and the light patterns that emerge from that.
Yes.
You're saying on the show this morning that you're going to lead this tour and people can book.
Yes, this is correct. This is absolutely right. I mean, the easiest way to reach me is just via my website, Gareth. You know, it's just, there's an email, in fact, a public email, info@davidblock.co.za.
Very good.
info@davidblock.co.za. That's the way to reach me. But the point is, yes, I've been doing astronomy tours for, since the early 80s, I think. I remember taking up jets with SAA to see Halley's Comet. That was in 1986, Gareth, because the pilots were having great difficulty finding Comet Halley. I knew where to look. And so I was in the cockpit and I would guide the pilots guide the jets. Of course, they were doing the controls, but I would guide them as an astronomer as to what to do to change altitude and azimuth to find Comet Halley. So I've been doing that, looking at, I remember taking jets up to Namibia to see Comet Hale-Bopp. And in October of this year, I'm taking a group to see the Northern Lights again. That's fully booked.
Wow.
Because the point really is, why do I undertake these tours? Very few people have access to the sort of networks, Gareth, that I do. And I love to be able to let others experience what I experience daily, as it were. And, you know, whether it be a solar eclipse or whether it be the aurora, I just can't explain to you. I remember, you'll remember, of course, Clem Sunter.
Yes, of course.
Of Anglo-American. Anyway, some of his family, his wife and son, came to Bike Bridge. There was a total eclipse of the sun there. And we erected tents to live in, because it was right in the bush and you had to be again in the path of totality. So we actually erected, I was the leader of this group, but we erected a tented village so that everybody could sleep in luxury tents. And I remember people coming out of the event and then we looked up at the sun and the eclipse, and people were weeping. And I think that's what you were saying earlier, is it's not only cerebral knowledge, but it becomes emotive. It's a hugely emotive experience, whether you're standing under the aurora or whether you're standing under the shadow of the moon or the shadow of the earth. These are unforgettable moments. And you're right, Gareth, I've been leading these astronomy tours, I guess, as you say, since the early 80s, starting with Comet Halley. And what was so interesting, there's a lovely little story there, Gareth, is that the CEO of SAA said, "Prof, you've got to take 5 jets up." I said, "Well, I can't cut myself up. My brain needs to be in one place at one time." So I got 4 of my senior students. I trained them how to find Halley's Comet from above. And so they all got... So I said to the CEO, "I'll train the students, but these are students without any money. Give them some initiative to look up."
Right.
So he said, "Well, Prof, what do you have in mind?" So I said, "I have this in mind, sir." I said, "I will be the leader of the group, but for the other 4 jets, I want... I'll have each student, one of my students or 2 of my students in the cockpit per jet. But I said, I want them to get enjoy around the world ticket free of charge." Now, SAA was so desperate because the pilots couldn't find Halley's Comet that he said, "That's a done deal." And so I was so excited, Gary, because here I was as a prof, and yet my students, 4 of them or 6 of them, I can't remember exactly how many jets went up, but they each got round the world free tickets. Some went, I think, to Hawaii
That's fantastic.
That was a real team event.
So, Prof, I'm curious also, what are the exact dates for anybody who's thinking about their calendar for next year? How long will you be going for? And where can people, besides emailing you, can they go and find out about this on your website? Just give us the logistical details.
Well, that's very interesting. I'll tell you what our great dilemma is that Egypt, you've got to be able to fly with me from Cairo to Luxor. This is the difficulty.
Right.
And booking opens in 2 weeks' time because they open a year ahead, and August the 2nd is around the corner. So this is my challenge, is that Egypt Air only has a finite number of seats.
Flights.
And we have to get the people. So in other words, the key date is August 2, but if you want to arrive on August the 2nd, you'll miss the eclipse because of the crowds. Right. So the plan is this. I would like to arrive, say, 3 or 4 days earlier than the 2nd in Cairo, fly then to Luxor, probably be in Luxor from around July the 30th. We've got to be there about 2 or 3 days before the eclipse, just to settle down. So it's about July the 30th, I would think, somewhere around there. And then get a flight, an early morning flight from Cairo to Luxor. Then board it's called a Dahabiya. It's very interesting, Dahabiya. These ancient, the boat's not ancient, but it's the sort of boats, the Dahabiyas, the pharaohs use.
Yes.
And then we've only got spaces for 10 couples, because it's not a very, very big boat. I mean, this is small.
Sure.
But the thing is that, so we'll arrive in Luxor, following your excellent question, Gareth, we'll arrive in Luxor on about the 30th of July. And then I think it's going to be a 7-day cruise. In other words, from the 30th to say about the 5th, the 5th or the 6th of August. But for the eclipse itself on August the 2nd, we will definitely be on land. Now, what grieves my heart so much is if you go onto the websites, and there are large numbers of them, I have to warn your listeners, their timings are crazy wrong. And also, the worst place to observe a solar eclipse from is on a boat. Why? Because the boat's rocking. The boat's moving. I mean, it's staggering how these cruise liners work. They've got people brimming and full to the brim. So, you know, they're sold out. So you're standing and it says you'll observe the eclipse from the deck. Well, you know what happens. The ships are moving so much you can't even hold the Coke in your hand. I mean, it spills. I mean, there's
okay,
something...
Okay, so importantly, you won't be on the boat when the eclipse takes place. You want to be on terra firma. So you'll climb off. You'll find a nice place near, who knows, the temple of Luxor itself. And you can then observe the solar eclipse and then get back on the boat afterwards.
Well, that's exactly right. That's why I'm going to Egypt now. Exactly that. I want to see where you need to disembark from.
You're doing a recce. You're going to do a reconnaissance mission.
That's exactly, you know, in the old army days, which you and I remember, Gareth, there would be these recces, these reconnaissance missions. And, yeah, that's what this astronomer who's now no longer lecturing at WITS, but whose horizons have opened up yet even further, is that we need to do a recce. You can't just get off the boat on August the 2nd and hope to find a good spot. You need drivers. The vast numbers of logistics. I have to meet with the managers of certain, the managers of hotels, maybe use their grounds as observing grounds near these ancient temples. I have to be away from the crowds. But nearly every single cruise, which is still available, and most are fully booked, as you'll see if you went online, is that they say observe it from the ship. And, you know, I'm the only astronomer, I think, who has said, please get off the ship. I mean, you don't want to be on a ship when this jolly eclipse is taking place. So there's all these intricacies, Gareth, which mere mortal minds do not always comprehend.
Prof, I think that for many people, the real pull of something like this would be not to watch the eclipse, but to watch you during the eclipse. So have you got a plan of what you'll do for those 6 minutes? Because it's a very limited amount of time, and obviously that's the focal point of the whole trip. So have you prepared some interesting thoughts and ideas? Have you started to write down what you'd like to be doing during those 6 minutes?
That's a very, very personal, question indeed. I will be focused entirely on photography during the 6.5 minutes. I will be giving my group specialized glasses to look at the eclipse, so they will be able to look at the eclipse. In fact, I am ordering these. These are handmade. They're very sophisticated glasses, which are needed to actually observe the sun safely. But while everybody else will be looking up for the 6.5 minutes, Gareth, I then move into sort of the ultimate mode, as it were, in the soccer match. I have to be photographing the moon obscuring the face of the sun, and I'm using, I've ordered very sophisticated equipment to do this. You need highly sophisticated camera gear to do this, very sophisticated lenses, very sophisticated filters. And I'm trying to, what am I trying to do in those 6.5 minutes? I want to capture the prominences, you know, those giant solar arcs, which you see during totality. I want to, what I also want to do is try and photograph the coronal streamers. Now, we always think the sun is just this round ball, but they're actually streams of gas stretching 20 or 30 solar radii out from the sun, which you ordinarily don't see. But there's something more, Gareth, which people don't realize, is that you'll be able to see stars. In 6.5 minutes, it's dark enough for the eye to get dark adapted. So stars will start appearing in the daytime sky as well. So I want to photograph all of that. And that takes me back to this very important eclipse. I don't know if you remember the eclipse of 1919, Gareth, when Einstein's theory of relativity was proved. It's incredible.
No. Obviously, I wasn't alive, not even you, Prof.
I wasn't alive.
Your great wisdom and experience, not even you were alive in 1919. But just tell us, for the sake, I mean, we've got smart people who listen to and watch this show. So explain to us how exactly that eclipse helped to prove relativity.
Oh, yes. No, that was extraordinary. You know, Einstein came along with the hypothesis that light does not travel in straight lines, but that light travels in curves in the presence of a gravitational force field. And so he predicted that the test for general relativity at the time was if you could photograph an eclipse of the sun, just what we've been talking about, a solar eclipse, and you look at distant stars, their paths should not be straight lined, but should be curved. And the astronomer who took this on was Sir Arthur Eddington. You'll remember there was that famous film and books by. So the thing was, Arthur Eddington was alive at the time and said, well, let's put general relativity to the test. Let's see if Albert Einstein is correct. And it's phenomenal. I mean, he led at that time in 1919. He led an expedition. He was team leader of an expedition. And they did what I'll be doing, but I mean, with very sophisticated equipment, they actually photographed the sun and the stars. They also photographed, actually coming to think of it, the stars behind the sun. And then 6 months later, they photographed the same patterns of stars again without the solar eclipse. And they found that the stars weren't in the same position. The stars had moved because the light, when the light from the stars passes close to the sun, the starlight is curved. We call them null geodesics. And Einstein was sent a telegram by Eddington saying that general relativity had been proved. And the world went wild. I mean, if you just Google the New York Times, any media in 1919, you just Google 1919 Eddington solar eclipse. Einstein's theory, I mean, that was the cornerstone, Gareth, of setting the whole of cosmology on a very solid theoretical footing, on a completely different, because up to then it was Newtonian physics, right? That light travels in straight lines.
Right.
And Einstein had said, no, light travels in curves in the presence of gravity. And this was all proved, and not many people realize this, perhaps, of those listening to us, but this was all proved in 1919 by Sir Arthur Eddington and his team. And Albert Einstein received the telegram, and from then on, everything was ignited. I mean, general relativity became the benchmark of everything, and we understand the expanding Big Bang universe, and we understand active and conformally active symmetries, and all the rest of that stuff. But it all came back to a solar eclipse led by Sir Arthur Eddington in 1919 to set the cornerstone, you know, of modern Big Bang cosmology.
I always try to squeeze as many things in when I have you on the show, but I saw this week there's a story in the news which you'll probably know about, but many other people won't, about how in Chile, I think they're busy doing a photograph of the universe, which is going to take some 20 years for them to do, but they'll get to look at very, very distant parts of the universe and parts that haven't been documented, photographed, plotted, mapped. Ever in human history. And this is a project that is international. There are many countries involved. It's been some two decades in the planning. And they're going to be taking pictures of heretofore undiscovered galaxies. They're going to map the motion of galactic bodies, whether it's comets and asteroids or planets or stars. This is fascinating stuff. I mean, how much has technology made astronomy expand? How much has technology given to astronomers who only have two eyes, no matter how good they are, and who only have 24 hours in the day and have to sleep and eat and do normal things like the rest of us, even though you're superhuman? How much has astronomy developed and advanced because of modern technology?
You know, Gareth, that is just such a brilliant question, because I cannot begin to describe the technological leaps. When I first was a guest astronomer at the European Southern Observatory in Chile, my exposures were on negatives. The size of the negative was about 12 inches by 12 inches. In other words, this sort of size. That was the size of the negative, possibly as large sometimes as two A4 sheets. It was extraordinary, and we worked on glass. The exposure time was around 3 hours. And I spent four entire years for my doctoral thesis in the darkroom, getting my hands wet. Every day I would work in the darkroom, photographing and then developing photographs of galaxies. Now, in a fraction of a second, I mean, in a microsecond, you know, you've got the digital arrays and they give you images in real time. What you're describing is from Chile. The very dark skies in Chile is from this. I'm just so excited at the comment. Oh, I'm so grateful to you, Mascarene. You're just great. You helped me look up. But to come back to the technology, Gareth, it is extraordinary. It is beyond imagination what I am able to capture today, which I could not even conceive or dream of when I was a first guest astronomer in the early days of the European Southern Observatory in Chile. We can scan the skies. We can see galaxies nearly 14,000 million years ago. We can actually probe the beginnings of space. We can probe the beginnings of time. We can look at distant clusters of galaxies. We can look at black holes in the centers of galaxies. We can look at gas, Gareth, streaming into the centers of galaxies and into these massive black holes such as Sagittarius A star. It is exceptional. The technology, just like with our mobile phones, none of us could ever imagine 20 years ago that, you know, we'd have a little app on our phones telling us turn right, turn left and everything else. Well, on the astronomical front, it's just become extraordinary. I mean, we are living in an era now where you can park your telescope and within minutes you can start gathering photons from the very echelons of space and of time. I cannot begin to describe even the technology I'm taking to Egypt, you know, the lenses. They used to weigh like 12 kilograms. Now I can carry them in my hand, Gareth. It is extraordinary, the photographic sharpness, the photographic skills have evolved so much that the Luxor event is going to be so much easier. I mean, so much easier, photographically speaking, than Sir Arthur Eddington. It's leaps and bounds. Gareth, your sound has disappeared. I don't know
Sorry,
why.
Sorry, Prof. Goon911 says, what is your take on aliens, Prof?
Well, you know, it's a lovely question, Goon, and I look up a lot. I hope I look up a lot. I think I do. I do. And I've never been convinced that there's another Goon on Mars or on Jupiter or anywhere else in the universe. And I am perfectly convinced that there's only one and only one, my friend Gareth Cliff, and there's not another Gareth Cliff in around Sirius, for example, or Alpha Centauri, or Proxima Centauri. So I am of the dubious kind, is that I've spent a lifetime traveling, being a guest at many observatories around the world, the Australian National University, the observatories in Chile and elsewhere, and I've never seen these flying saucers. So I know it's a great rage, but I want to also caution the public on this note. You mentioned in your introduction, Gareth, AI.
Yes.
And it's very, very important for your listeners to be aware that a lot of apparent news, astronomy mm-hmm. news, is not news at all. It's generated by conspiracy theorists using AI. And I am sent, I have a friend, Delia, and she lives in Spain, and she is now sending me regularly to vet many, many posts which are appearing on Facebook. And I can see that they are all AI generated. I conducted a little experiment, Gareth. This would interest you no end. I generated, using AI, an image of the aurora above the Union buildings. Now, nothing can be more hilarious than that, because you have to go to Norway to see the aurora borealis. It's called the Northern Lights, not the Southern Lights, the Northern Lights, the aurora borealis. Not the aurora australis. And so I generated, I said, create an image for me, aurora borealis, above the Union buildings in Pretoria. And I posted this image, very, you know, just posted it and said, just get up tonight and look at the Union buildings, and above the Union buildings, you will see the dancing Northern Lights. Well, of course, the public went crazy, you know. Wow, really? What time should we get? What time do we go out to the Union buildings to look at the aurora borealis? Gareth, it's staggering. It's staggering how AI is taking over in terms of generating deep fakes. And so much of the news today, I'm sure in your domain and in my domain, especially of astronomy, is AI driven. And some people are unfortunately believing, you know, the fact that the aurora will appear above the Union buildings. I have to caution all your listeners, Gareth, to check with me or check with others, but don't simply believe everything you see these days with regard to astronomy, because there are all these deep fakes out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for people who don't know, you became a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society when you were only 19 years old, and you've devoted your life to paying attention, to learning, to, as you say, spending hours and hours and days in dark rooms developing pictures of the universe. And I mean, you spent more time thinking about this than most of us spend time, you know, doing things like eating or sleeping. So you're the man to check in with on all of this stuff. And obviously AI brings enormous advantages. I mean, there are ways that, for example, you know, computation can be carried out that can plot the course of an asteroid or comet. Absolutely. and can be worked on 24/7 by machines that are able to communicate with each other and do a huge amount of processing that would be a waste of a human brain. But when it comes to believing the truly extraordinary, there are so many things in the universe that are already mind-blowing. We don't need to start making nonsense up as well. I'm frankly disappointed, Prof, that you would be putting out fake news like an aurora above the Union buildings. It's very irresponsible of you.
Well, the point was, I wanted to test. It was a social experiment. And I wanted to test, are people aware of the degree of gullibility? It was a social experiment. Yeah. I just wanted to test one image. And it proved one point to me that people, as you say, the universe which I've devoted my life to, you know, Gareth, to studying, is so majestic and is so beautiful and is so grand that there's no need to generate AI images of it. The universe which occupied the minds of Einstein, the minds of Newton, the giant astronomers of old, even going back to Galileo, they were so captivated, you know, by the glory. I'm thinking of Galileo, the excitement of looking at the moon through his telescopes and the sun and so forth. And there's no need to generate. We need to AI, as you say. It's incredible. You know, I can write a book, put it on a little AI model, and it'll tell me if there are any spelling errors within a microsecond, a 500-page or 200-page story. That is extraordinary. And AI with coding and all the rest, absolutely extraordinary. But the point is this, when it comes to observing solar eclipses, when it comes to the real thing, you don't want a virtual marriage, do you? Or a virtual partner, Gareth. Mm-hmm. You want the real thing. And I think that, Goon says he's selling tickets to Alpha Centauri as a social experiment. I mean, that's right. I mean, it's in the same vein, it's like observing the eclipse of the sun from a boat, a rocking boat. I mean, it's the same sort of thing.
I mean, here's a great question from Bitcoin Boots, who says, if the doc could go for a ride in a spaceship, would he?
Yes. That's a very interesting question. I think I would. I did send, I don't want to name the person, but I did send a WhatsApp to somebody you'd all know. And I said I'd be willing to go. I think I was turning 60 at the time. And I couldn't get him to part with 220 million. But you remember Mark Shuttleworth, of course, spent that
money. Yes, of course.
And you know, to these giants, 220 million is, I would love to go up into space and see the pale blue dot myself. But I'm very happy to explore the universe with my camera lenses, with my telescopes, with my photographic equipment and so on. But coming back to that very interesting question, yes, I think it's, you know, I remember once speaking to Cathy O'Dowd and I said, why did you climb Mount Everest? And she said, oh, I needed to experience the excitement of climbing, you know, one of the world's great peaks. And yes, Gareth, I tried to relieve the South African of a couple of, well, I suppose it was 220 million. His bonus, you know, some of these gentlemen I approach, their bonuses are more than that. I mean, it's you lose a year's bonus.
You know, you're still full of life and vitality. And the way Elon Musk is moving, I think it's not an impossibility that that you may get some gilt-edged invitation one day to go to Mars. Who knows?
One never knows. Which invitations might come one's way. I remember, you'll remember this too, Gareth. I received a message by email from the personal assistant to Stephen Hawking. You'll remember that.
And yes,
she
right.
said to me, can you please arrange, Stephen Hawking has a dream to meet Nelson Mandela. Can you please facilitate that? And I did. In fact, if you Google just these four words, great minds, Mandela, Hawking. Just those four words. Great minds, Mandela Hawking. You'll see a picture of the four of us sitting in Mandela's office. Hawking, Mandela, Pukwuerter, and myself. I'm the only one who's still alive from that group. But the point is, yes, those guilt-ridged invitations do arrive. They're very unique. They're very special. You know, people say they would have loved to be a fly on the wall at that Hawking Mandela meeting. It was absolutely unique. But yes, my life has taken very interesting turns over the years. I've been privy to be with Madiba a few times. He named our twins, you'll remember, Gareth Nkwenkwezi, Star, Tevye Nkwenkwezi Block, and Nathaniel Ketile Block. He named and signed their birth certificates. So maybe that guilt edge. There we are. Oh, my word. You've got it. Your team is so good. So there is a very historic picture. Brings tears to my eyes, actually, because I'm the only one still here. But there's Stephen Hawking at left, and then Nelson Mandela looking at me, and then Pukwuerter, who looks as if he's slightly in distress, and myself. And I'm very animated at that meeting because I was asked to explain to Mr. Mandela the wonders of space, superspace. In other words, to unpack Stephen Hawking's book, The Brief History of Time. That's what, and I had about a half an hour to do that. Now, Hawking, of course, couldn't talk due to his the ALS, sure. The muscular disease he had, and so. So they asked me to explain A Brief History of Time. It's one of the world's best-selling books, as you know, of recent times. Sold, I don't know, tens and hundreds of millions of copies. I'm not sure what the figure was, but anyway, the point was, these guilt-edged invitations arrive to tug onto your question, and they are extraordinary moments. I think that orbiting the Earth is indeed an extraordinary moment, but until that invitation arrives, for me to be able to take groups to Egypt, for me to be able to take groups to Norway, just for me to help people to look up.
I love this. So next year, put it in your calendar and start saving up so that you can start looking up. Professor David Block will answer your questions. You can email him info@davidblock.co.za. There it is up on the screen. And Prof, I think this is such a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I mean, to be, of all places, in Egypt is just extraordinary. What an amazing place to be able to watch a full solar eclipse for 6 minutes on the ground near the temple of Luxor, near the River Nile, at the origin point of so much of human history and even astronomy. It's quite an exceptional opportunity, this, and I think it's going to be very, very special. But thank you, Prof. It's always hugely inspirational when we have you on the show, and you teach us so much, and you help us to kind of think about the context and the perspective of everything. How little we are, and how much we can see from this vantage point. It's amazing.
It is absolutely. We're living in such an extraordinary time. And as you know, don't miss when a goal is scored. And I think this Luxor event, just as you've so beautifully described, come with me. There are only 10 spaces available, 10 cabins. But come with me. Let's look up. And let's experience not only this together, the neurophysiological processes, but the joy, the wonder, the awe of the moment of the moon sweeping across the sun. But Gareth, allow me to thank you personally for allowing me to be on your most precious show, going back to your early radio days. And now, yes, somebody told me yesterday, David, are you aware Gareth's downloads exceed 15 million? I said, oh, yes, there's a star on Earth, too, and his name is Gareth.
Okay, Prof, I love it. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to see you, and we will catch up with you soon. Don't forget what Prof said. Put in your diary also for this year on the 28th of August. We have a lunar eclipse where we'll be able to see what he's only going to be able to see the solar eclipse. Only the people in Egypt will be able to do that. But we'll be able to see that lunar eclipse. That's on the 28th of August, early in the morning, so just before we start this show. Prof, thank you so much. What a pleasure.